Welcome to the Battle Archive. Since 2005, the Academy of Ideas has organised the Battle of Ideas Festival, with debates on the key cultural, political, and scientific issues of the day. We are proud to be the home for unfettered debate, the People's Parliament, the place where new ideas come alive in open discussion. And now, we are opening our vault, making our recordings of public debate available to you, free to revisit and share as often as you like. For more free speech content and news on our next festival, subscribe below or head to academyofideas.org.uk. But for now, enjoy the discussion.
Okay, good morning everyone, and welcome to the first keynote debate of Battle of Ideas Festival 2019. I'm Alistair Donald, I'm the Associate Director at the Academy of Ideas, and for this year, along with Ella Whelan, I've been the co-convener of the festival. We wanted to kick our festival off with a debate about an issue that I'm sure many of us are troubled by. What is the meaning and viability of solidarity in the 21st century? And when I look at the papers and the news and the discussion, I think what you notice is that there's a couple of ways in which the issue of solidarity is discussed. Sometimes it's discussed in a way that is a kind of mournful way, where people say, well, it's broken down in the face of an atomized society, eroded levels of trust, declining kind of communal organizations, and rising individualism, the kind of me society. And the second way it's discussed, I think, is fairly common, is that to the extent it does exist, it's often accused of merely being a gesture. So it's a kind of the changing of social media profiles to express solidarity with people who've been in a disaster or victims of a terrorism attack, or kind of writing a letter in solidarity with someone. Perhaps this week, the Chilean protesters, or also this week, actually, some of you might have noticed the 72 MPs that wrote a letter to the Duchess of Sussex expressing solidarity with her suffering invasion of the press and so on and so forth. In fact, there was even this week Canadians who were wearing pyjamas to work to express solidarity with people in the developing world and their poverty. So I think kind of what we want to do with this discussion is to try and look at what is the meaning of solidarity today, how it expresses itself, perhaps how it's changed compared to the ways historically it was expressed, and also to ask the question, well, what can we do to recover a sense of solidarity and to shape solidarity in the future? So to do that, I've got four fantastic panellists to help us discuss this. I'm going to introduce them in the order they're going to speak. So first up on my immediate right is going to be Paul Embury. He's a firefighter, trade unionist, and trade unionist. He's a columnist for Unheard, who are one of our new festival media partners, who've very quickly established themselves, I think, as a kind of go-to website for some of the most interesting articles, and a kind of real mix of writers around just now. Paul's very active within the Blue Labour tendency, and his articles often focus on the growing disconnect between the working class and the left. So maybe that's a chance to explore some of that with Paul. Second on my far left is going to be Roger Eatwell. He's Emeritus Professor of Comparative Politics at the University of Bath. He's co-author with Matthew Goodwin of the, I suppose, much referenced book National Populism, The Revolt Against Liberal Democracy. And amongst other things, his research has investigated fears about the destruction of national and local communities and the impact of fears about the future. So welcome to you, Roger. Third, we'll have Anne Elizabeth Mutte, who's a columnist at The Telegraph. She's co-founder and vice president of the Institute Jean-Jacques Rouchet. She's previously been Paris bureau chief for the European, France editor for Newsweek Europe, and she frequently appears as a commentator in France and indeed elsewhere on all sorts of issues, particularly stuff like the Gilets Jaunes recently. So welcome to you, Anne Elizabeth. And finally, we'll be hearing from Professor Frank Faraday on my immediate left. He's a sociologist and social commentator. He's a Battle of Ideas regular over the years, also appears regularly in the published and broadcast media. I'm sure you've seen him. He's a host of books to his name, but to highlight two recent ones, he's the author of How Fear Works, Culture of Fear in the 21st Century, and Populism and the European Culture Wars. So just a word on the format, and I'm sure you get used to the format of the discussions over the next couple of days for those that haven't been here before. But I'm this is kind of common type of format that we'll have for the panels throughout the weekend. I'll ask each of the speakers to throw out some opening remarks for about 5 to 7 minutes. I'm going to be quite strict on the timings, because the whole idea of Battle of Ideas is that we have enough time to bring the audience into the discussion. So with a minute to go, I'll kind of tap on the water, alert you to the fact that you've got to start winding up, and I'll stop you after 7 minutes. After that, we'll come straight out to the audience for your questions, and we'll get a discussion going. So kind of be thinking as they're speaking about any questions or points that you want to make, and we'll have plenty of time for discussion, and I'll give them time to sum up at the end. So over to you, Paul, for your opening remarks.
Thank you, Alistair. Do I need to press this, or can you hear me?
No.
Okay. I've been told to stay sitting so that the microphone can pick up my voice. Thank you for the introduction. I'm assuming this is the non-rugby fan cohort of the of the Battle of Ideas Festival. So thank you for coming along. Solidarity in a fractured society. Well, as a trade unionist, I appreciate the value of solidarity and what it takes to build and maintain a common interest. I've stood on enough picket lines to know that it's that common interest between workers that has allowed the labour movement to tackle many of the social and economic injustices throughout history. But I have to say that when it comes to the question of solidarity today, I think that large parts of the left are getting it badly wrong. Because what we see today is a political and media class, and the leaders of the modern left have fully signed up to this, which has adopted with the greatest enthusiasm an ideology that not only makes it harder to build social solidarity between people, but in many cases has actively undermined it. This is a political class whose worldview is broadly liberal, broadly globalist and cosmopolitan. The people who advance it are often usually part of that urban, university-educated, middle-class group that has so little affinity, apparently, with those millions of working-class people in the grittier kind of post-industrial and coastal communities up and down our country. And not only do they have no affinity with them, but they're often contemptuous of them. They think that working-class people who hold to such notions as a sense of place and belonging and cultural attachment are nativist and reactionary and bigoted. And these people often obsess over the politics of identity, not realising that far from uniting people, what they're actually doing is driving them apart and placing them in their own exclusive boxes according to such things as their biological traits. And they are dismantling human solidarity, in my view. They think that as long as you hammer on about economic unfairness, then the serious polarisation of society, which we've seen grow, will suddenly evaporate. Not realising that working class people are actually not motivated solely by a desire for economic advantage, but value such things as community, stability, tradition, place, human relationships, and so on. Because in the end, there are a multitude of things that can bind or separate human beings. Economic interest is only one of them, and Workers of the World Unite doesn't even begin, in my view, to solve our problems. Language, custom, culture, religion, nation, social mores, these kind of things which have often developed organically over generations and which still matter to millions, these things can foster the strongest solidarity between people, and we have to treat them carefully. Because when you don't necessarily have the education or wealth or horizons or opportunities to move around that so many of the political and cultural elites do, these things can take on so much more meaning. And that's why when they're violated by such phenomena as rapacious globalization or deindustrialization or large-scale immigration, things that can whip through communities very quickly and cause rapid and deep-seated change and disruption, you invite blowback from those communities. You are, in fact, weakening the bonds that have sustained those communities for so long. And at its most extreme, you're rupturing relationships that people have developed with neighbours and workmates and local institutions. And that's why so many on the left are wrong to think it's just about economic factors, that we can assuage the anger and alienation of so many of our working class communities simply by repeating the message about the need to tackle austerity and economic inequality. Yes, it's important to do those things. As a trade unionist and socialist, I get that. But to think that the anger of working class people will disappear only by promising them a few quid more at the end of the month, I think, is to misunderstand the priorities of those people and what matters to them. And secondly, it's actually to advance really a Thatcherite argument that says it's all about the economy and nothing else. In the end, it's not just the class struggle that matters. Solidarity between people is built on more than their commonplace in the economic system. In the borough where I grew up, in Barking and Dagenham, 12 BNP councillors were elected at the local council elections. This took place in 2006, before the global financial crash and before many people had even heard the term austerity. Before then, Barking and Dagenham had been dominated by Labour. It was a traditional blue-collar place. But so angry were local people at a political class which had ignored them and treated them with contempt when they dared to raise concerns over changes in their community, changes that served to dismantle the type of social solidarity that had sustained the place for generations, they decided to vote for the far right. And that's what they'd been driven to by an establishment that tried to persuade them that a globalist, liberal, cosmopolitan, open borders future really was in their interests. What the political and cultural elites thought was great for themselves, they assumed would be welcomed by others. The people in Barking and Dagenham were not racist or xenophobic. It wasn't their sense of race that had been violated. It was their sense of order, their sense of solidarity, everything they'd known and were familiar with. And when they were ignored and patronised, thousands simply up sticks and left. That's the tragic thing. The solidarity that had been a central feature of the place for generations was breaking down. And that's why I argue that we need to challenge those who preach the gospel of globalisation and of liberal globalism, whether it's the rapid and large-scale movement of capital or labour. Both can cause social and economic disruption in working class communities. No place can stay the same forever, of course. Why should we want it to? And we've all got a duty to get on with each other and treat our fellow human beings with dignity, whatever we do or don't share in common with them. But if you're going to bring about far-reaching change in communities that are built around cultural attachment and social solidarity and tradition and custom, you'd better do it carefully. Otherwise, you're asking for a reaction. Because even in the 21st century, with global interconnectivity of a scale we could only previously have dreamed of, place still matters to people.
Last minute.
We're seeing fragmentation of our communities on a scale like never before. We're seeing, and I think this is a real threat, the undermining of the nation state. The nation state is, for me, still the best example of democracy we have at its highest level. There's never been an example of a political unit larger than the nation state, which fosters a spirit of mutual generosity among citizens while allowing them to exercise democratic control over their rulers. And that's why we should defend it. But it's under threat on the one hand from the economic globalisers who want to be free to shift vast amounts of capital across borders without impediment, and on the other, the liberal internationalists who think the concept of nationhood generates hate and division. And they are wrong. And I conclude on this. In the end, solidarity isn't about wearing a wristband or sharing a hashtag. It's essentially human at its core. It's about nurturing and defending the things that really matter to people. Family, work, community, place, local institutions. It's about human relationships and the things we hold in common beyond mere economic factors. And we should challenge those things that undermine it. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Lots to think about in that opening remarks. I'm going to go on to Roger now. So your thoughts, please, Roger.
Well, thank you, Paul. I agree with a lot of that, as you'll see. Building social solidarity is a vital goal in today's society. And I think to understand why, we need to ask just how fractured society is. And I'm going to take most of my examples from Britain, but I will look at some other countries as well. And I think if we look at Britain today, there are two broad approaches to this question of solidarity. One, and I think it's probably the dominant approach, stresses social division and polarisation. So if we look, for example, at incomes, the top 1%, you've got to earn about £120,000 a year to be in the top 1%, have gradually got richer, and particularly the top 0.1%, you've got to earn about £500,000 to be in that group, have got even richer still. And at the same time, the average person, working class people especially, but a big chunk of the middle class, have stagnated, not just since the recession, but really since the 1990s. And in fact, if we look at Britain and many Western countries, we can see that levels of inequality are at about the level they were before the First World War. And remember, in Britain before the First World War, no women have the vote, and nearly half of men don't have the vote. So we're talking about a non-democratic society. And if we turn to polarisation, just take a couple of examples. There was an opinion poll done last month by YouGov, and this showed that 69% of English Remainers, leavers, and 57% of Remainers were willing to engage in demonstrations that led to harm to other people if it meant that they got their way. And of course, if we look at MPs, particularly female Remain MPs, large numbers of them have received threats. So these are the kinds of things you would use if we were trying to stress social division, you were trying to stress polarisation verging on violence. But there are dangers in a kind of ahistorical analysis where we don't look back and we look at times in British history where there's also been very high levels of division and polarisation. And probably for most of you, the obvious period to look at would be Thatcherism. I mean, if we look at the 1980s, there's a whole raft of doomsday books from academics, from journalists and so on. But we come into the 1990s, we see economic growth revive, we see Tony Blair create a new consensus, or at least a new consensus before the Iraq War and the Great Recession harms this. And also, if we look at the 1990s, the new millennium, we see a raft of opinion polls that show really quite important changes, like racist values are declining. We can see this particularly if we look at issues like, do you support mixed marriage, which is a common surrogate for racism. Large numbers of people today support mixed marriages. If you look at polls in the 50s and 60s, very much not the case. So what you get with this more optimistic scenario is that once Brexit is over, you will see a whole series of ways that we can come back together. Just to take some concrete policies, large numbers of people support more spending on the NHS. Large numbers of people support more spending on schools. Many support renationalisation of industries like transport and so on. So this is the idea that we're really not in as serious a crisis as we think. If you actually look at underlying trends, there's a lot in common between British people. Now, my own view is I think the violence argument is overstated, especially if we ignore threats to MPs, which I think are a very serious threat, but this is not a social threat of violence, and we ignore the far right. I think there is a serious and growing threat from the far right, particularly to Muslims. But I think the chance of mass social disorder in the foreseeable future in Britain, certainly anything like the Gilets Jaunes process in France, is quite low. But where I do tend to agree with the pessimistic analysis is I think there are at least two social trends that we need to pick up that are very worrying. And I think these reflect a qualitative change from the 1980s. They're not new. They can be traced back decades. But something dramatic's changed in the last decade or so. And I think, in particular, this has helped fuel Donald Trump, Matteo Salvini, and a lot of the national populists have been rising. And the first I'll call the death of the American dream. The American dream imported into Britain in the 50s, if we work hard, we will get better off. Not only will we get better off, our children will get better off. Large numbers of people seem to be concerned with globalization, concerned with a new level of automation, and believe that they will not see this. So to take some concrete figures, if you look at 2016 in America, 26% of Americans in 2016 think they will get a higher living standard in the future and that their children will be even worse off. If we look at Donald Trump supporters, the figure falls to 11%. This is a very important factor in Trump's support, this pessimism about the future. And of course, more generally, under the same heading of the American dream, large numbers of workers now work in casualized industries, they work in low-skilled industries. One statistic, 60% of American workers today are paid by the hour. That means they're not only usually paid very low wages, they've lost health and a whole series of benefits with more structured employment. The result, massive alienation, particularly from the political class, but growing alienation from what some would call neoliberalism. So that's the first set of changes that I think are very fundamental. These are economic changes. The second set of changes concerns community, the nation. Paul touched on this. Large numbers of people feel their communities are being destroyed, be it local communities, their trade union community, their national community. And of course, in some cases, this is because civil society organizations that were powerful in the past, in general, are no longer very important. Churches, trade unions. But of course, other changes include those who feel that immigration is damaging their community, a feeling that has led large numbers of people, particularly on the politically correct centre-left, to attack the working class or the working class who primarily express this kind of sentiment as racist. I think this is a serious mistake. I think there are very few people in Britain, perhaps 5 to 10% at most, which is a large number, but it's hardly anything like a majority, who are truly racist. And I think we can see evidence for that if we look at a 2018 opinion poll done by Hope Not Hate. Hope Not Hate, I'm sure you know, is an anti-racist organisation, so it's hardly likely to promote research which minimises racism. It found that 85% of British people, this was in a stratified opinion poll sample, over 3,000 people, it found 85% of British people were what were called balancers. They were happy with immigration, but they asked questions about immigration. Just how many non-skilled workers do we need? And how do we integrate Muslims more? Because Muslims seem to be hunkering down rather than integrating more in the way that the Afro-Caribbean community did after the 60s and so on.
Final
I think
minute,
racism
Paul.
Undoubtedly remains
1 minute.
A problem. But overstating it is dangerous. Now, these two perspectives on the past point to the future, and as I have 1 minute left, I won't have time to develop them, so I'll just headline them. One is, we need radical socio-economic reform. We need to challenge inequalities. We need to challenge not only wealthy people who pay now 45% tax maximum, often less because they pay tax through dividends and so on. We need to challenge the companies like Apple and so on. And we need to do this in a variety of ways, including radical ways, like creating a solidarity economy, where, for example, in London, I went to a cafe recently where you could pay what you wanted. The poor paid nothing, and I would pay more because I thought I was better off than average. And the second thing we need to do, following on from my argument, we need to look at national identity. We need, particularly on the left and the centre-left, to accept that nationalism has, in general, been a force for the good. Nationalism is not Nazism. Nationalism can be liberal nationalism that tolerates difference, that tolerates pluralism and so on. But what we need to do, my final point to keep Alistair happy, is we can't use old conceptions of British nationalism. Old conceptions of British nationalism are about whiteness, patriarchy and so on. And what we need is a conversation about what new conceptions of nationalism can be inclusive, and not only inclusive, because we don't want a passive nationalism, we want an active nationalism where people will help each other. And I think that's a conversation we need to have, and I'm hoping we'll hear more about it today. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Rob. So I think we can definitely come back to some of those points and start to develop them a bit. Anne Elizabeth, your opening thoughts, please.
Thank you. Is that close enough, the mic? Yes. First of all, I would like to state that I am a rugby fan, but the French team is made up of virtuosi who have no solidarity among them, and therefore the lack of solidarity means that we lost early on. So I can be here with a clear conscience. Most of the early points I wanted to make have been made very well by my predecessor, so keep Alistair happy. I'm going to start in the middle, and then if we have time, I'll go on some of those, and go straight into the question of France. France is a country that used to have as a device liberté, égalité, fraternité. And fraternité is a kind of neo-romantic term, and it's almost disappeared, but it's been replaced by the word solidarité. And one should beware of that. Whenever a word becomes a device, usually it hides the fact that there isn't much of it in the actual society. The expressions of solidarité in France in all sorts of ways. And even on a tax, the ESF, Impôt de Solidarité sur la Fortune, is the wealth tax, very emblematic, which was made to make a political point by François Mitterrand when he was elected in 1981. And his first cabinet was comprised of communist ministers at a time when the French Communist Party meant something. That tax has become basically political poison for every following president. Eventually, Nicolas Sarkozy tried to lessen it, and he was immediately tagged as le président des riches, the president of the rich, withdrawing money from the rich to the rest of the population. Even though that tax costs about the same amount to collect as it brings in money, it's also created flight of wealthy individuals. And Emmanuel Macron, who has decided that he's neither left nor right and therefore sort of vacillates between one side and the other, decided to reduce the ESF into impôt sur la fortune immobilière and just tax property as being something that creates no riches. And it has also hit him with problems. His approval ratings are going up, and they have reached the amazing figure of 30% approval and something like 70% disapproval. So you can see that those things are seen very symbolically in France. But the French way of talking of solidarity, like many other things, are to a large extent state-directed and top-down. What is forgotten, and everybody will be talking about the Gilets jaunes, and Roger mentioned it, the Gilets jaunes are asking for more solidarity. And there is a problem in France, of as elsewhere, as in the north of England, as in Appalachia, for instance, where Trump voters are, of a whole group of citizens who feel that they've been left behind by the elites. This is expressed in slightly different ways all around the world, but it's all it's very common for exactly the same reasons: the lack of old values, the disappearance both of the Communist Party, which the French Communist Party, which was the most Stalinist of the Western Communist parties, was also a group within which a great deal of solidarity was organized individually and collectively. I would recommend to anyone a French movie of the 90s called Not Everyone Had the Luck to Have Communist Parents. It's a wonderful and heartening comedy, and it's about what it was like to be a communist in the 50s. And as long as we're not talking about actual sort of politics, the whole life of people revolved around what they did together with the party, etc. And that's something that created this in a way that in Britain, much more bottom-up, individual initiatives, working clubs, etc., created the same kind of solidarity in such communities. That's disappeared. The Catholic Church is very weak, and because it's weak, it expresses itself in political movements that are more extremist against gay marriage, for instance. Even though, it's a solidarity of protest and not a solidarity of initiatives. But most of the time, what the French want, and this is where we're different from others, is we want solidarity organized from the state. And we want it to be top-down, and we think that we're entitled to it. And to a large extent, people are not aware that they get it. France today, if you look at all the benefits and the subsidies that French citizens receive, if you take the median, a large median group of French citizens, about the 80% between the 10% richest and the 10% poorest, spread between salaries and from 1 to 7. When you've added all the subsidies and benefits, it's 1 to 2.5. That is actually more equal than in Sweden. And yet you have people who say, I can't live on this. They consider that free medicine is normal, and they should, but it still is the vast displacement of money. They consider that free universities are normal. They have been used to an extremely good infrastructure, and the revolt of the yellow jackets was started started because that infrastructure became so expensive that, for instance, small train lines were cancelled and people now need their cars. And when you legislate from Paris about speed and the green properties of an engine, you do not realise that this is affecting the possibility for people to travel, to apply for jobs, to keep those jobs, to take their children to school, to go to hospital, etc. And the feeling, the problem is that we are now going into a system in which when solidarity is something that you expect handed down to you, even though that is just and proper, the lack of initiative means that whenever your personal situation is wrong, you do not feel that solidarity belongs to you. We've had initiatives, some very good and some not so good, or some silly ones. The very good ones dates back to the 1980s when we get the first hit of globalization. And that's something called Les Restos du Cœur, and that was started by a French comic called Coluche, who died tragically early. And that was basically a food bank and restaurants where people could sort of eat to poor people. People who couldn't sort of fill their kitchens would come and eat. And the Restos du Cœur have increased. They've become an institution. They're subsidized by donors as well as by the state. And that was an interesting and new instance in which this came in France, something that happens much more in America, that happens much more here. But on the other hand, the French system gives more in unemployment payment, gives more in pensions, has the
final minute.
Some of the best outcomes in the World Health Organization for the. We don't have waiting lists, we do not have walls in hospitals, but we'll take this for granted. To finish this, and I'm sure it will get back into the conversation, I would just like to touch one word, and it's the solidarity movements. I will not go into the solidarity with the Duchess of Sussex. I think she will do just fine. But I would like to talk about the Je suis Charlie movement and the solidarity. I march for Charlie. I knew the founders. I knew Kavanagh and the Professor Choron. I work on a television Frank's talk show where some of the murdered Charlie cartoonists came every week to comment on the news with us. At the time, I wrote a piece in my paper, The Telegraph, that said that France had changed, that people felt a solidarity. But I was wrong. The warm feeling of solidarity that you share in the middle of a demonstrating crowd has little to do with the real world. And as it turned out, too many of us loved Charlie out of habit without reading it. And 4 years later, many of those who marched at the head of the crowd on 10th January 2015 have denied their slogans and their tweets, and they now criticize the cartoons. They criticize, they foster the idea of Islamophobia as a criticism of religion. Of course, not the people who practice this religion. And the society is more fractured now than it was in 2015 when we have 4 million people in the streets of France to try and defend our particular brand of bad taste humour. I'm sorry to end this on pessimism, but I'm pretty sure that the conversation will work for solutions.
Okay, thank you very much. I thought it was actually quite a good place to start, and it's kind of nice to get a perspective from a different country as well. So that's very useful. Frank, over to you and your thoughts.
Yeah, I'd like to take a step back because the thing that I'm very interested in is how does our problem of solidarity compare to that of previous generations, and what is really distinct about it? I take the view that there's something unusual going on, which is probably for the first time in history, in the modern epoch, we find it very difficult to find a language even through which solidarity can be expressed. And whenever the word solidarity is used, it's used in the way that Anne Elizabeth talked about it, Je suis Charlie, which is at best a performance of solidarity. It's the kind of disaster tourism you get when there's a horrible event. People go there, they check it out, they wear the T-shirt, and they go home. It's the kind of demonstration of solidarity that we had when Princess Diana died. I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember that maudlin, horrible reaction where people are laying flowers and leaving toys and everything else and feeling really good about it and then taking a selfie to indicate that I was there too. So it is very interesting that solidarity has been denuded of content in much of the Anglo-American sphere, as far as I'm concerned. And even in the past when there was fractured societies, for example, Roger talked about the Thatcher era. What's very interesting about the Thatcher era is that there was solidarity on both sides. the miners watched each other's back during the miners' strike. The ruling class had a l'esprit de noblesse oblige, a l'esprit de corps, which meant that they stuck together. They weren't like these feeble Tories you got around now, you know, are scrambling over each other and briefing against each other to the press. They had real solidarity existing. Now, we haven't got any of that, neither in the working class, nor in the ruling class, nor anywhere else. And I think that's very unusual. It's, to me, a relatively new development. So the question is why? Why is it that we've now got this concept of solidarity that's been denuded of meaning? And the conclusion that I've come to, I've been kind of studying this for like the past 2 or 3 years, is that the main reason isn't economics. It's not because of globalism, although that's not really helping. It's not because of neoliberalism. That's not really helping either. I think fundamentally what we have is a cultural accomplishment here, because we live in a world where we've lost a common web of meaning, which always underpins a view of the world. There isn't a common way of looking at things, where we speak a common language, even when we disagree with each other. And you get to the point now where everybody that I know in England always said, I've got to watch my words, you know, in case I'm misunderstood. Well, I mean, that's a new development, because there was a time when you could talk naturally without having to fear that somebody will say, I'm offended, you're this or you're that. So we haven't even got a language. But more important than that, there's a powerful cultural dynamic which systematically attempts to call into question every form of what Hannah Arendt called pre-political ties. Every relationship that exists outside of formal public life is now called into question in Western culture. You take something like the family. Now, the family has historically been the site where you practice solidarity. I mean, if you can't even rely on your mom and your dad, your brothers and your sisters, how can you expect to then go out and expect strangers to look after you? These days, the family is seen as a site of violence, of domestic abuse. It's very dark. We have to open the door to the family. And even you have sociologists, you know, I'm a sociologist, I'm sometimes very embarrassed about being a sociologist, who talk about the fact that, you know, the family is inherently, you know, sort of dark, a site of violence. We have to kind of open it up. And they make the point, they use this word, which probably is the word I hate most in the English language, it's not inclusive enough. I don't know if you ever heard, nothing is inclusive enough. Well, actually, a family shouldn't be, you know, sort of inclusive, otherwise it wouldn't be a family, right? It would be like a kind of a community party where everybody could come along, you know, so, you know, with kind of multiple fathers and multiple mothers. So the family is not inclusive enough, and therefore there's something fundamentally wrong with it. And then you look at other pre-political relations, intergenerational relations between children and their parents and their grandparents and their community are always the kind of cultural and moral infrastructure on which solidarity is built. I mean, we do things for each other because we have a common memory. We do things for each other because there's something that you cannot put into words that binds us together. What do we have today? Every British mainstream newspaper loves talking about the generation wars, how the boomers have messed it all up. And you now get this situation where we kind of encourage 14-year-olds to kind of carry placards, adults, you ruined the world for us, or adults, how stupid you are. You know, if you have this kind of complete mistrust being built within the generations, very difficult to have solidarity. What you do is you have this relational conflict in a more fundamental way. Communities are always denounced for not being inclusive enough. You know, sort of, we need to have exclusive communities. Well, exclusive communities don't exist because they wouldn't be a community anymore. If every single door is open, if everybody is together, then you have a kind of Karl Popperian abstract man. I mean, Karl Popper wrote this horrible book called Open Society, which I think is the Bible of the cultural elites at the moment, right? Basically said, I prefer abstract man detached from every single organic link to a community or to a nation or to family. I prefer that person to the way that people really are. And that sense of dehumanized and deterritorialized and denationalized and deculturalized image that you have of the way that the world works, I think has become extremely powerful. And in particular, it's become extremely powerful because it's given an incredible degree of weight by our popular culture. I mean, when was the last time you've seen a film or a TV program where the family is depicted in a positive term? Have you seen a film with a happy marriage where everybody finishes, everybody's smiling at the end instead of beating the shit out of each other? I mean, you just don't get that. You know, do you ever see films and songs and anything else where pre-political relationships between generations and within a community are presented in an idealized way? You don't have that. What you have instead is this continuous celebration of the fragmented individual, the individual who's so brave that they come out and they kind of embrace a new identity, an identity you probably never heard of, right? And because they kind of violate all the links and all the bonds that have created a sense of community in the past, that's meant to be kind of held up and celebrated as a kind of brave kind of development, as a kind of brave individual.
Last minute.
So that, I think, is a real problem, because as long as you got that, we don't even have the language of solidarity, never mind having real solidarity. I think the wonderful thing about the present moment is that people are reacting against this. I'm a big fan of the new populist movement that has emerged, not because I think populist movements are necessarily the last word in political theory. They're often very confused. They're very disoriented in terms of what they're trying to say. But the wonderful thing is they're trying to find a voice. I mean, unlike Roger, I don't have problem with Salvini. I don't like Salvini's politics. But I spend a lot of time in Lombardy and in the Italian north. And when you talk to ordinary Italian people, they say for the first time, there is somebody there that understands what we're going through. You know, we haven't got those people in Rome who don't particularly care about us. We have people who want us to be part of a conversation. And I think the wonderful thing that we have at the moment is that people are trying to be taken seriously. They want to be part of the conversation that is going on. And they are expressing that politically in a very confused, often in an irrational manner, as you would expect. So what do we do here? I think what we have to do in this situation is we need to get together, find the intellectual and political resources that can give their voice some kind of future-oriented, transformative potential politically. I think that's a real important challenge to everybody in this room, particularly the younger generation. We need a new politics that can radicalize that populist voice so it's future-oriented rather than just being a prisoner of the past. And we need to make sure that this occurs in a way that takes into account our humanist instincts, the fact that we are human beings and we kind of band together, but at the same time mediate between the particular pre-political loyalties and the wider challenges that humanity has faced. Thank you.
Thanks, Frank. Okay, everyone. So lots on the table there. You might want to pick up on the stuff that's been mentioned about the historical differences or differences across different countries and cultures. There's the kind of entanglement or otherwise of the kind of economic and cultural factors, globalization, so on and so forth. So there's lots on the table. I'm going to come straight out to questions. One very important thing. When you ask a question, you need to stand up and speak into the microphone so that the camera people can see who you are. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take clusters of 3, 4, 5 questions maybe. I'll then come back to the panel. We'll get some answers and some discussion going, and then we'll come back out and back and forth again. So I'm going to start right up here in the top right-hand corner. So there's someone with a hand up there. Has someone got a microphone that's going to go up there? Right up at the top, there's a cluster of people. So if you can just hand the microphone round that cluster of people. Just give it to the guy that's nearest, first of all.
This might sound like hyperbole, but is there not a danger that the new left is actually drifting into an updated new form of fascism, not just in terms of its instinctive desire to suppress freedom of speech, to move away from accountable representative government, but the way in which it sees society as a series of mutually exclusive groups, oppressors and oppressed. I mean, it's interesting that a Nazi theorist, academic, Carl Schmitt, is now actually quite trendy within some new left circles. So Chantal Mouffe, in her book on what she calls radical democracy, argues that there is a lot of validity in Carl Schmitt's analysis of societies as being divided between enemies and friends. And it seems to me we're really in danger of moving into a style of politics which can't sustain liberal democracy because there is no conception of society as being a common entity. And if you don't have that and you don't respect the right of other people to differ from you politically, then you are moving into highly authoritarian waters, I would suggest.
OK, can you just hand the microphone to the back row behind you?
And then hello, hi. Is there a form of nihilist wish fulfilment brought about by a sort of tired decadence, do you think, in the West?
OK, and just hand it along to the guy in the back row.
Thanks. I just want to come straight back on what Anne-Elisabeth Moutet said regarding France, and I don't get too boring about France, but I keep up on what's going on there, and how much she sort of, I would say, represents the elitist snobbism that the likes of Macron promulgate in France about how people don't realise how lucky they are to live in France. And you must all be stupid to think you've only got 800 euros to live on each month, etc., etc. So, but on the other hand, I want to be more positive about what's been happening there and say that one of the interesting things is that what worried me initially when the Gilets Jaunes started out was they were saying, we're not political, we're just people who are, you know, want to have problems finishing their end of their months. And actually what happened after a few weeks is they began to say, actually, shouldn't we have more control over the kind of decisions that are made? And there was a referendum d'initiative citoyenne, which has become part of the main political outlook of the thing. And they don't see themselves as political, or they see themselves as cross-political. And that's a very interesting development about people demanding more say in their everyday affairs. Just one other quick thing, which is she also decided that all the Catholics had gone over to reactionary causes and were against gay marriage and all this sort of thing and become extremists. There's a very interesting thing going on at the moment, which is something which would surprise people, I think, in Anglo-Saxon countries, which is that there's a big debate about whether or not assisted procreation is a good thing, in other words, IVF type treatments, because it removes the father from the equation. It basically giving the right to lesbian couples to have IVF and for single mothers to have IVF. And there's a very interesting debate going on, which I'm not sure where I stand on it, because I'm very pro science, I'm very pro giving people the opportunity to have babies, etc. But I'm also very interested in how we are eliminating the father in some respects from that process and destroying, in fact, undermining the family in the way that Frank described. Thank you.
Okay, can I see? I'll take another couple. So there's someone in a white shirt and towards the middle. Can you pass that microphone along? And then there's this lady here in the white. So lady in the white shirt, go, and then you and... Yes.
Thank you.
So yes.
Frank was saying about the impact that the kind of watch your words phenomena has. I think what goes along with that is the identity politics idea of who you can speak on behalf of, and the idea that you must stay in your lane and you can't speak on behalf of anybody who doesn't look like you and appear like you in a very limited sense. And I think that sense that you can't appear to sympathise or empathise or be able to speak on or for or be, alongside other people is really damaging to solidarity. And I think one way, I mean, the point was made about people being more supportive of mixed marriages nowadays, but a survey came out in August and it said that 2 in 5 Remainers would be upset if their son or daughter wanted to marry a Leave voter. So we've got kind of new points of differentiation that are emerging. And like I said, I think you know, just very divisive.
Okay, and...
Okay, hi, thanks. So I think what we're seeing in lots of Western countries is some kind of rise of a new administrative class. So I'm from Germany, so I'll give you some examples from there. For like in the state of Hesse, they put little beer mats into all of the pubs or into many of the pubs where you can take a picture of a QR code and then learn about Islam. So on the beer mat, it says, why do Muslims wear veils? And you can sort of inform yourself by getting redirected to a website. Or in Berlin, which is where I'm from, we have a food committee, which is commissioned by the council to develop a food strategy for the whole city with activities around healthy eating and so on. And I think we have around 20% of society which identifies with the values of that administrative class. So they're into identity politics or into we should promote consuming less meat and or so on. And we have maybe 80% of society which don't identify with that and who feel they're being constantly re-educated. And I think that the problem with that is, and it's not just the working class, I think it's big parts of the middle or upper middle class feel this is strange or going in the wrong direction. And I think the problem with that is that it's not compatible with democracy. If we say we have this group of people which is in charge of guiding and re-educating everybody else, I think that doesn't work. And I think that is what is fracturing society or threatening community in a more democratic sense, as like civic virtue, and we're all equal citizens, we can participate in shaping society. I think that doesn't work.
Okay, thank you. So I'll come back out again in a few minutes, but I just want to come back to the panel just now to get some responses either to any of the questions that have been asked or if you want to pick up on any of the opening remarks and come back on those. I mean, Anne Elizabeth, you might want to directly respond to the question
might.
To you.
I thought I might, yes.
Why don't you go with that, and then we'll come to Roger for perhaps some. You can answer Roger some of the criticisms or the kind of stuff that was going on that was maybe a little bit different to you. But let's go to Anne Elizabeth first.
Thank you. And before I answered the gentleman up there, I must say that the idea of learning about Islam when you drink alcohol seems this wonderful example of underrated German humour. I think it's. But first of all. It's not because I describe something that I say that this thing is a good situation. And indeed, if you provide and spend so much on a program, on a series of welfare programs that eventually leave people dissatisfied, then you have failed. And the questions we should be asking ourselves is how come that the French state spends 57% of GDP on public expenditure and still it manages to get it wrong? And indeed, the beginning of the Yellow Vest movement was, it then morphed into different things, but right at the beginning, it was really suddenly a sort of a meeting of solidarities and regions were in places where there were no longer jobs, where, again, we don't have zero-hour contracts, but we had the closest equivalent that could be possibly thought by the local employers. And people who met on those roundabouts in rural France in the first months of in November and December of 2018, they said, this is the first time that I speak with people. I'm not alone. And that was really something that was very strong. The movement has petered out for all sorts of reasons, and we may talk about it later. But again, the whole idea of, the state works in France. The liberal economists in France used to say that the problem with the French plan, which was what rebuilt France in the post-war years, was that it largely worked. But there's a limit to the idea of just waiting for the stuff to come from the state, and there must be other ways of making people partners in this. That would be the only thing I would say.
Do you just want to then give us a sense of what your answer is as to why that's petered out in solidarity sense? Because that might be quite useful just to push us on a little bit in this.
You mean solidarity or the Yellow Vests?
Within the Yellow Vests.
Okay, I'm going to leave the Catholics aside. They won't like being left aside.
Leave the Catholics for now.
The the thing about a movement that decides that it has no leaders, no organisers, doesn't want to be part of the political game because it loathes all politicians because they're part of the elite, is there are limits to this, because at the end of the day, you know, people who were who appeared as spokespersons for the Yellow Vest were not chosen by the Yellow Vest themselves. They self-chose on Facebook pages, and, for instance, an early petition by Priscilla Dudowski was taken up because it were well-written and it made very strong points. And then she received numerous threats and insults because she was, you know, she was pushing herself in front of everybody else. And we've had numerous examples. There were lists that wanted to be in the European elections representing the Yellow Vests, and they were immediately criticised by the rest. But what happens is that you end up with a movement with mob rule, and then you have some cynics who come and manage to hijack the movement. And what really is worrisome about the way the Yellow Vest movement has changed was the fact that as there were fewer and fewer people in the streets, some of it was just attrition and exhaustion. And it's costly even to take a night bus to come to demonstrate in a large city. You can't do this every Saturday on and on and on again. You had a number of conspiracy theorists who captured the movement. You had anti-Semitic slogans. You had people explaining that all of this was a plan by, you know, some shadowy bankers. And this was depressingly familiar.
So just on that then, so this kind of... setting out to kind of self-organise and to generate that solidarity, but it's failure. I mean, what accounts for that?
We were all wondering, but I think it's a movement that did not organise itself. You know, when you look at the French Revolution, you had the Estates General, you had the Cahiers d'Alliance, which were those books in which people wrote what they needed, and they were taken into account, and then the there was the delegation to leaders. Now, we are witnessing a sort of rejection of representative democracy. You see this in this country as well, you know, where your MPs are supposed to be traitors because they don't do at the minute what you want them to do at that specific minute. And the idea that you can create a movement that will get somewhere is unfortunately that was a demonstration and it not working.
Okay. Let's hold it there for now, okay. and hold those thoughts. We can come back to them again. Roger, just okay, whatever you want to pick up, really, but I wondered if you wanted to respond to some of the perhaps lesser support for the fact that this is a kind of economic thing and more of a set of cultural circumstances. Which was partly, to be fair, some of you.
Okay, there's a massive debate among academics about whether populism of the Farage and Marine Le Pen Trump type is caused primarily by economics or cultural factors. To some extent, it's shadow boxing because I think it's both, and trying to separate them out is very difficult. I mean, I don't want to turn this into an academic seminar, but I think an important concept comes from behavioral economics that argues that most people are not rational economic man. They're very confused. They don't really understand what makes them tick and so on. And they use something called heuristic. Now, heuristic's a very jargon term, but a heuristic is when you answer a question or you discuss things in terms of very simple ideas. So, for example, in South Wales in 2016, I think Aditya Chakraborty went to a South Wales village, found there was no immigrants in sight, but when you asked people what the issues were, they said, oh, it's all to do with immigration. Now, I would argue that's a heuristic, that in fact what people are saying in this South Wales village is the coal mines are no longer here, the trade unions are no longer here, there's no sense of community still here, and the Daily Mail and the Sun have told me it's all about immigration. So I think when we're trying to separate immigration out from economics and we're using opinion polls to do this, it is very difficult. In fact, if you look at earlier this year, immigration is a very low-ranking issue among British voters and so on. I think some of Frank's arguments are more interesting. I think a lot of the high-level arguments about economics versus culture is just a methodological problem. I think when we start looking at the family, how children are brought up, millennials and so on, those are much more interesting discussions. And I think that, you know, if I was giving a longer talk, that's something I would have got into, especially some of the twangs on the millennials and so on. But I just chose to focus on really what's been the core debate about populism, which is economics versus nationalism / identity.
Okay, Paul, you want to pick up on the left fascism point?
Yeah, it's I mean, I don't know that I would use the word fascism in terms of some of the stuff we're seeing from the left nowadays. And I don't think we should necessarily play that game where we use it loosely. But there is certainly a high degree, in my view, of authoritarianism creeping into the left. And I think it's, you know, it's affecting the labour movement where I work, that, you know, once upon a time, whereas people used to say, I disagree with you on this, increasingly now they're saying, you mustn't say that. That's where we're shifting from a genuine disagreement around the merits of an argument to someone saying that because they disagree with you, you don't really have a right to express that view. And it comes down to this thing about offence, doesn't it? You know, people taking offence or people giving offence as if people have a right to be ring-fenced from offence. And my view on that is very simple, that, you know, I don't believe in gratuitous offence. I don't believe in just going out and upsetting people or abusing people or insulting people just because you can. But if you have a genuinely held view, whether it's a political view or anything else, and you express that, and a consequence of that is that someone takes offence, then, you know, the reality is the problem is theirs. The problem is with the person who has decided to take offence at the expression of a genuinely held view. So there is a worrying degree of groupthink on the left now. And as I say, I see it in the labour movement and the trade union movement regularly, where there is an echo chamber. You see it, to give an example, you see it around the whole question of the European Union, where so many people on the left now look at the relatively small number of people on the left, people like myself, who supported Leave, and they can't comprehend it. They can't understand that anybody should want to subscribe to what they think is, you know, the sort of fascist, reactionary, populist measure to take us out of the EU. I mean, on one level, it betrays a complete misunderstanding and a lack of knowledge about the history of the left on that particular question. But it's like those views are simply not welcome. Rather than engaging with them and trying to deal with them, they're not welcome. And just a, you know, just a final point, we've seen it, just really briefly, we've seen it recently in the debate in Parliament, politicians, where there's this war on metaphor. I don't know if you've noticed it, but, you know, people are using old, you know, metaphors, which we use all the time, like surrender, the surrender bill. Or, you know, Boris Johnson's going to form a war cabinet or stuff like that. Everyone knows what it really means, but politicians are deliberately going out of their way to misinterpret it and to say that, you know, these things need to be taken literally. And it is an attempt to close debate down. We should see it for what it is. It is an attempt to delegitimise a particular view and to stop people from expressing it. And it's so important, we need to challenge these people head on. We can't kowtow to them. We've got to challenge these people.
Frank, just anything you want to pick up on quickly?
Right. Just kind of starting with one of the last point that Roger made. I don't actually think that people in Wales or anywhere else are somehow different or have different attitudes because they read the Daily Mail or the Sun. Because if you look at the way that the media works, the way human beings are, people, you know, so even if they're having a very, you know, a PhD in economics, are still fairly selective in the way that they sort of make sense of the news. And it's, you know, and I've seen a lot of studies now, and this has been going on now for 30 years, where it's often, the point's often made, isn't it really funny? It's in those communities where there are no immigrants who are most worried about immigration. I mean, I heard this argument time and time again, and the assumption being that these are idiots, you know, I mean, they're just, you know, completely irrational. For some reason, their views are, you know, simply doesn't make any sense at all. But actually, when you talk to those people, you know, you'll find that what they are really worried about, and this is where the immigration issue becomes important, is that there is a whole set of narratives that are circulating within society that basically treats them like foreigners in their own country. And you don't need to have, you know, and many of them are actually like individual immigrants. That's not what the issue is. They feel like foreigners in their own country because when they watch the BBC or ITV or Channel 4, they find that they're being represented as deplorables, as kind of low lives, people who really haven't got any moral moral characteristics that are Elkanah positive. And there's a kind of profound sense of alienation that's there. And they may have their prejudices and preconceptions, but the prejudices and the preconceptions of the so-called deplorables are really the mirror image of the prejudices of the more elite, more culturally educated section of society, who, when you hear them talk about, for example, a Brexiteer, or when you hear them talk about, you know, somebody who votes for a populist party, they actually, in their minds, they imagine this is Kristallnacht around the corner. That, you know, the numbers of times I heard professors of universities using the expression is just like the 30s. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got to be a moron, you know, with all that education, to basically say it's just like the 30s. And the repetition, and they really mean, at first I thought they were just using that for effect, but they really must have these nightmares of people in brown shirts knocking on their door, you know, sort of, and revisiting this. And I think that there is that, but I think it's important to realize that the, you know, that the kind of basic attitude of the demos is, if anything, you know, more enlightened than the people who think that they're more aware or they're more enlightened. And certainly what I've been finding, I've been going around talking to people who've been voting for populist movements in Italy, in Germany, in Hungary, and I find that they kind of remind me of 1960s, 70s trade unionists. I mean, that's what they remind me of in terms of their basic kind of character. The only difference is that the labor movement is conspicuous by its absence. You know, there is no real labor movement, but the attitude that they have, the way they talk about one another, their mates, that kind of call, is very, very similar, except that they haven't got the kind of language that the old labor movement had, which was based upon 150, 200 years of experience. Can I just say something about decadence?
One, very quickly, yes.
I hate to use the word decadence because of the fact that it's usually old-fashioned conservative reactionaries who use that, but in my own head, I often use it all the time now. And, you know, I don't like to say it in public. And the reason for that is because, strictly speaking, what decadence means is that the gains of humanity, the gains of civilization, the things that we struggled for in the past that were really positive, we're giving up on. We're kind of losing. And we're not only giving up on, we're making fun of, and we're denouncing it. And I think under those circumstances, it is legitimate to talk about maybe decadent trends. You know, because at the same time, you know, there are obviously positive trends within society. So we don't want to go too far down the road. But there are definitely very clear signs of Western decadent, you know, malaise kind of kicking in, which in many respects is something that we need to take a little bit seriously because we don't want to give up on the legacy of human achievements.
Okay, thanks, Frank. So, right, lots of hands. So let's start up there in that corner. Is there a microphone up there? Yes, yes. Any of those, yes. This is three people up there, and then we'll come over to this side. Yes, yeah. Go on.
I was born British, so it's been very shocking, the massive increase in race crime in this country recently. Does Roger really think that that piece of research, I don't know which year it was, really reflects the number, small number of races? Do you think that these small number of races just acting out as a result of the inflammatory language at the top and so on is resulting in this kind of massive rise of race crime? And what do you think of the role of inflammatory political language in people at the top in terms of fracturing and having an impact on our potential national inclusive identity?
Okay, can you hand the microphone to the guy in front with the white shirt?
Thanks very much, guys. It's been super fascinating. And this is kind of directed at Paul, but maybe it's something we can all kind of bear in mind. And I'm not going to win any friends here, but I am middle class. I live in London, and I am what you would call, a social elite or cultural elite, a member of that. And I'm probably not the only person in the room who's part of that, but I'm probably the only one who's going to stand up and say it on mic. And so I know firsthand that, you know, a lot of my contemporaries think everyone who voted Brexit was a racist. A lot of them undermine community. A lot of them think that, you know, they're obsessed with their identity politics. But I also have a lot of contemporaries who are not. And I think the danger that we kind of fall into, and I say we because, trust me, I kick lumps out of them as well. The danger that we kind of fall into if we are trying to communicate with them effectively is if we're doing the very thing that we are saying caused this problem of division, so creating generalizations, creating a kind of stereotypical enemy. If we are doing the very same thing, I don't see how the sort of common language that you spoke of, Frank, I don't see how we're going to get to that common language, because to me, from, you know, my side of the debate, whatever side that is, I think essentially it's just hypocrisy in a way, and I think it's slightly kind of intellectually a little bit lazy. If that's what we're giving out to them for, it just feels slightly, yeah, okay, hypocritical.
There's a lady with a microphone there. That one needs to go to this guy here.
It was just a quick question, really, about when you talked about the gilets jaunes and the fact that it's kind of fading, you mentioned that people were self-appointed leaders and that people have stopped following them. And I just wondered about the question of leadership. Obviously, in this country, we don't really have leadership in any form at all. I think some people hoped that Boris Johnson was going to die in a ditch before he didn't leave the EU, but he didn't, unfortunately. So what makes a good leader? Is it a kind of... You know, both sides have got the problem in that the you've got a fractured, individuated individual, but also you've got no sense of leadership. As soon as someone stands up, then usually they're attacked morally as opposed to intellectually for what they're wanting to lead on. So what is it that could give the conditions for leadership?
OK, so the guy with the microphone there, there's someone else up there for next. Yes, go on.
Just in terms of, talking about fractured society, I mean, Paul made this point about, you know, you can't say that. You know, that's the sort of thing that you can't say. Actually, it's kind of a bit more than that, isn't it, now? Because, you know, if you do express an opinion which is not the opinion you're supposed to have, it's not just that you can't say it, but that leads to people saying, actually, you know, we think you should be sacked from that job, you should be removed from that post. Some people in the room have had more experience of that than others. But that kind of leads on to a bit more than that. So it's not just fractured society, it's kind of different societies, you know, where people, I mean, people say echo chamber. I mean, what that actually means is different types of people only talking to each other. So, you know, deleting people on Facebook, you know, blocking people on Twitter, you know, those sorts of things. Now, you know, a long time ago, you know, when trade unions were very active, you know, if someone scabbed during a strike, then you could delete them on Facebook, because actually that was someone who was actively acting against, you know, the interests of that particular community. That's kind of very, you know, scabbing is kind of very different, you know, to just having a different political view from someone. So, you know, there are some kind of, you know, real kind of tangible, you know, issues here, not just about you can't say that. Just want to very, very quickly just say about some positive things. I think one of the positive things, recently on the tube, when the XR individuals got on top of the train, you could see people kind of, you know, grouping together and saying, we need to get them down because we need to go about our business. And also, there are small parties being elected in different parts of the country, you know, around particular small issues. So I live in Newcastle. There's a small party called Newcastle First who are kind of looking to do something about that community. Sounds like they're far right, but actually they're not. They're looking to do something about the issues that affect those, you know, small communities.
OK, thanks. Can you hand the microphone to the guy in the yellow shirt? And there's someone with a microphone here.
Yeah. There's a lot of talk about identity politics, and often that phrase is used in a negative light, almost like it's anathema all the time to building solidarity, to creating togetherness in a society. It's all exclusively here, it's been mentioned negatively, but I think I'd like to ask the panel, and it's an open question to anyone in the audience as well, could they be a bit more specific about what they mean here? Because, I mean, if we look at, for example, the civil rights movement in the US in the 1960s, gay rights movement, those are movements that were coalescing around interests to do with their identity. And with hindsight, we look back and we say, you know, that's brought society together, that's made us a more tolerant place. I mean, Martin Luther King Jr., he's looked in a society as polarized as America is looked at almost as a symbol of national unity. So I just want to kind of get some more specifics on what's meant by identity politics and if people think it's a universally bad thing.
Okay, so I've still got lots of hands. I'm going to get this guy in the yellow shirt. Then if you can bring the microphone down to this person here, then I'll come back to the panel. First time I come out, I'm coming to the guy in the blue shirt. All right, so, yes.
Good afternoon. I think my question builds on my friend from London. And it's this sort of like this evacuation of a common language that was suggested that has sort of led to the polarization that we see in our politics. But can it also be argued that this evacuation of a common language has been as a result of more capacious space opening up for a lot of voices that are marginalized? And a lot of those voices now are being sort of brought into the mainstream. And that rather what we have is sort of like a lack of understanding of those different voices, and also we are not really able to listen.
Okay, thank you. And Stu, and then I'll come back to you, Paul, for start picking up some of the questions. Yes.
Yeah. Roger, you spoke about the need to create or foster a kind of national identity or solidarity. But how do you do that? Because there are attempts today to do that. For example, in schools, British students are taught about British values, but I think these attempts are often quite hollow. So how do you create national identity and solidarity?
Thanks. That's a really useful question, actually. Paul, anything? I mean, you might want to pick up on that as well as Roger, actually, but anything that you wanted to come back on?
I was going to, if I could just briefly come back on our middle-class friend up there. I do think you raise a very valid point. I think I did qualify my statement originally by saying they are often middle-class, liberal, sort of urban. Okay. So point taken on that. And I think you're right. It's important not to generalise and not to overdo false binaries, if you like. But I do think it's undeniable that there is something that David Goodhart, for those who have read his book, The Road to Somewhere, covers very well, where he talks about, you know, 50% roughly of the nation being the somewheres who are rooted patriotic, often in working class communities, 25 being the more sort of university educated, liberal, urban based anywheres, and the other 25% sort of being somewhere in between. But it's the 25% in the cohort of sort of liberal university educated people who have so much influence and do so much to dominate the culture of society, and actually think that what is good for them and what they enjoy, axiomatically, everybody else should enjoy it as well. And you're right to raise the point, because I do think, I mean, I'm a member of the Labour Party, and I've always argued that actually, you know, if the Labour Party is going to return to power, it will have to be a coalition between its, you know, traditional working class base. I've never argued that you just need to appeal to that sector and you'll romp to power. They need to build a coalition between that group of people and, if you like, a layer of less tribal middle-class people who are open to Labour ideas. So I certainly do take your point on that. Can I make a really brief point about the Gilets Jaunes? One thing that strikes me, and it should be mentioned more, is the abdication of responsibility of the British left, in particular the trade union movement, to throw its weight behind the Gilets Jaunes. They have completely disowned it, and I think it's disgraceful. These are people, broadly working class people in France, who are fighting for greater economic justice, for national sovereignty, for greater democracy. And the so-called internationalist trade union movement in Britain, which in a heartbeat supports every other global struggle of workers fighting back against the system, has turned its back on the Gilets Jaunes because, you know, they're probably a bit too working class. You know, they're probably a bit too salty. They might have some pernicious influences. And I think that shows the divide between the leaders of the left today and working class people and the scale of the disconnect.
OK, I want to give Roger a chance to come back on the nationalism question.
OK, well, I was going to say something about racism as well, because I've been banned this year from speaking at Warwick University, and I think the argument's more about race than national identity. But, since 2001, the riots we had in Northern England and the Cantor report on community cohesion, schools have increasingly put emphasis on teaching about what it is to be British. And I think you get a list, is it five or six factors, the rule of law and democracy. I mean, this is tick box teaching. I mean, I don't want to be rude to teachers, and usually this is being taught to people before the age of 16, but it has almost no meaning to people, that kind of list. And it's easily contested. So in the Brexit election, we didn't have a democratic, rational debate where people are telling the truth. It was a debate where both sides told lies, and large sums of money came in from businessmen, you know, wealthy businessmen, many of whom financed the Brexit campaign. So my point is, it's very easy in school just to teach this list, but to pick up from news and so on, a lot of these things were best contested. I mean, I don't go into school and teach people before 16, but I go into a lot of schools and teach 16 to 18-year-olds. In fact, I'm here on Monday in Camden School in London. You'll have a look on their website and you look at the programme they put on for sixth formers. When they sent it, I was just amazed at what they were teaching, the sophistication in this school. I've nothing to do with this school. I don't know anyone there. They asked me out of the blue to go and speak. And I think what we need to do in schools more, and I suspect it can be done before 16, but it certainly can be done between 16 and 18, is teach democracy and national identity in terms of values. For example, there's a very famous Oxford philosopher called David Miller, who's argued that nationalism is a kind of meta-ideology. It's central to socialism. Socialists want to redistribute from rich to poor. How do you redistribute from rich to poor? It's much easier if people have a strong sense of identity, a sense of bonding, and so on. Now, I don't think those kind of ideas are only for university students.
Okay. I'm going to come to Anne Elizabeth and Frank for some very quick comments on a couple of things. Then I'm going to come back out for a final round of questions. So I'm going to need to keep the questions fairly short and snappy. The first one's going to be from the guy in the blue in the centre. But Anne Elizabeth, just pick up very quickly, because I want to get back out to the audience, on possibly the question of leadership.
Yes, there were two points about the Gilets Jaunes, and one was actually made by Paul, and there are reasons for that. But the question of leadership is has got to be accepted, because otherwise it doesn't get you anywhere. And I'd like to make a very unpopular case for old-fashioned politicians. Right now, what united the Gilets Jaunes was contempt for the elites, the contempt for professional politicians. And in every country, we've seen a direction, a trend towards that. Term limits. In France, we have something which is we forbid people to now hold two different mandates at the same time, which they could before, so that you had lots of MPs who were also mayors of their towns, and that was very helpful for them to keep grounded in ways that otherwise they were not. If we make the profession of politicians impossible for various ways, by contempt, etc., we are going to find ourselves at the mercy of strong men or strong women with a great deal of contempt for democracy. So that really worries me a good deal.
Okay, let's just leave it there. Frank? Okay.
This is about the guy with their identity politics. I think there's a fundamental difference between the civil rights movement, which was not identity-based. It was a civil rights movement. And there were, within the movement, small sections who anticipated what would be identity politics, which is very much about you as a person. If you look at the most important slogan of identity politics, it is that the personal is political. It's all about me. I mean, that's really what it's all about. And it's basically creating a situation where it's almost impossible to make a distinction between your politics and your persona. And that's where the problem of language comes from, because if politics is you, and if I criticize your view, you will say that I'm criticizing you as well as an individual. You can't separate yourself from the criticism. And under those circumstances, dialogue becomes impossible, because if I just say you're wrong, you will see it as an attack upon you as an individual. And I think that development has really hardened in more recent years. And it seems to me that relates to the point that the guy was making about voices, because actually the new voices that we're hearing at the moment are very much within that framework of it's all about me. And it is very difficult to listen to that. I mean, he's actually right. We aren't listening because it's impossible to listen, especially as our culture is continually inciting more and more new voices, more and more new identities to emerge, because that's the only way that society, that the culture at the moment, sees it's possible to kind of go forward. I think it's wrong about the race crime. If you actually look at the figures, it's a complete fiction that somehow we're going through an epidemic of racist crime. Similarly, it's a complete fiction that hate crime is on the increase. sometimes it's a fiction that universities are engulfed by this wave of racism. I think if you critically examine what those surveys really show, you'll find that they're all what we call advocacy research. They're all setting out to demonstrate a particular political point and kind of discovering what they set out to prove. But the reality is that genuine, real race crime, the one that I fought against in East London for many, many years, that fortunately is really on the decrease and is nothing like the way that figure suggests.
Okay, thanks, Frank. Well, can I just go back out, though, because we've got very little time left.
Just make a quick point on the race crime. Look at the 2017 FBI report, which is not an advocacy report. It shows an increase in racial crime, but it says it's partly because they collect more. The question was about causality between provocative language and crime. The attacks in America on Muslims declined after Trump came into office.
Okay, so I'm going to come out for one final round of questions. There's quite a lot of hands still, so they're going to have to be very quick to get as many as possible in. After that, I'm going to come back to the panel just for a final minute of sort of summing up thoughts, and perhaps one of the things that you might want to think about in that final minute is just this question of how you kickstart something for the future, because there's been quite a lot of questions around that. So I'm going to start with the guy in the blue, and then it's going to go to the guy behind, and if that microphone could go up to the top there. So yes, go on.
So I guess we're all here because we believe in the battle of ideas and we want to shape the future through debate. And what's interesting about today is the extent to which the liberal left, the social justice warrior left, if you like, have completely abandoned that whole approach towards winning hearts and minds. I mean, they now adopt this finger-jabbing approach of you can't say that. And if you do, then you've got some sort of phobia or suffer from some ist, or you're going to be driven off campus, sacked, or generally silenced and treated as a non-person. I just wondered if you got any ideas as to why this has happened to that strata of person, who do all come from the left. Just finally, I wanted to congratulate all of you because I think you have all been very courageous and eloquent over many years in giving voices to people who have been denied voices because of the censorious times that we live in.
Okay, there's a lady at the top there, and then hand it back to the guy there. Excuse me, hand it back there. Anyway, the lady at the top, yes. It's Claire, yes.
She's no lady.
She's no lady.
No need to go, the lady at the top, oh, it's Claire. I think that one of the important things about solidarity has to be judgment. And the reason I say that is because I think, Frank, you talked about inclusive a lot, but you do have to be able to decide who's in the club, who you're in solidarity with. I mention this because there is some concern in schools that young people are too fragmented and individuated and isolated, so they're forming kind of friendship clubs, and actually you get into trouble if you exclude anyone from them. And it just struck me that this is actually, it seems like solidarity, but forced solidarity, enforced solidarity, is actually incredibly destructive. Surely you have to be able to say, I don't want to be friends with you. I don't want to act in solidarity with you for solidarity to mean anything. So I just think that judgment is very core to the kind of solidarity that we move forward with. It has to be organic, in other words, rather than kind of top-down or imposed.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to take the guy with the microphone there, and then one more, and then we're going to come back to the panel. So, yes, go on.
Yeah, it's very difficult to have a conversation now because just words that we used to understand and have a common understanding around, we no longer understand. So if you say the word liberal to different people, it means something different. Democracy means something different. Patriotism means different things to different people. So even just having a common language is different. I'd be very interested to just hear one word from each of the panel members that they think we should really work on to try and own and make sense of and elucidate a sense of vision that we believe in. I imagine from Paul the word's going to be solidarity, but I don't want to just give that to you. But just one word would be very interesting.
Okay, final point. Who is... Yes, there's a guy right at the back in the middle. And I'm going to... Once you've just made your very short point, I'm going to come back to the panel, take you in reverse order that you spoke to start with. So start with Frank and end up with Paul. So, yes.
Hi there. Yeah, very similar to the nationalism question, but how can we provide avenues for community, and in particular, how can we provide these avenues amongst the working class? Cheers.
Thanks very much. So, obviously, a huge subject. This is the first session of the festival, so some of these themes are going to return probably quite a few times across the course of the next couple of days. So this is not the end of the discussion, but really, in many ways, a way into it. But I'm going to give, a minute at the most to each of, highly inadequate, but a minute at the most to each of the panellists just for a few final thoughts, and I'll start with Frank and go in reverse order.
Yeah, there was a story yesterday you might have read about this young millennial reality TV star, a bit of a schmuck, saying on TV that we should stop teaching the history of the Second World War because it's too traumatizing for people. People get really upset, you know, sort of. And of course, you know, my reaction is, you know, that's the whole point. You should get really upset about a horrible event like Second World War. You must never forget that experience. But I thought that was very interesting because that relates to, I think, for me, what is the key problem, which is that we've lost historical thinking. Historical thinking has always underpinned any transformative moment. It's based upon the fact that you know that the world, the way that the world is at the moment, may change for the better, and that there were moments of when we had very bad experiences in the past, and there were some wonderful moments when people were able to make history. And the reason why I think historical thinking is so important is because once people begin to realize that history is something that's alive, that's part of their soul, then they can begin to think of themselves in slightly different ways. And one of the things I've been doing is going around also to schools, because I think the most important audience for this discussion is the 16 to 18-year-olds, when people are still idealistic and they believe in themselves. They haven't become cynical. I think it's really, really important to get across this idea of historical thinking, because if we can somehow create a synthesis between the idea of making history and the kind of populist desire for voice, if we can really kind of bring that together into a very active, interactive relationship, then what we can do is we can harness the energies that are coming to the surface at the moment for a really positive political and cultural result. And I'm actually quite optimistic. I've never imagined in my life that something like the Brexit movement could occur. I never imagined that in Italy, when I go there, you know, ordinary people are basically are saying, we're better than the politicians. They're not saying we're against politics. They're saying we're better than those politicians. I never imagined I would see a situation contrary to Anne Elizabeth. I think the Yellow Vests are quite inspiring. I mean, they might be messed up here and there, but when you go to Pas-de-Calais and talk to some of these guys, they really are serious people. They take themselves very seriously, and they look upon themselves as not like the objects of history, but people that can make things happen. And I think that's where historical thinking comes in, to give people those kinds of resources, to give them the confidence to stand up and fight.
Thanks, Frank. Anne Elizabeth, just a final minute's worth.
Yes. Right. I think at the end of the day, it's going to be difficult. I agree with Frank entirely on the sense of history. I think something that was best expressed by an Englishman, George Orwell, you know, the sense of common decency, kindness and curiosity, and not thinking that there are solutions that are, you know, already prepared for you and you just have to slide into them and you will follow the fashion. Most of butt movements are fashion trends. You know, it's fashionable to be woke. Don't be that person. I think because we've had so much top-down instances of solidarity and we know that they don't really... They do the broad job, but they don't do the fine job. The fine job is up to human beings. And the real solidarity is something in which you look at things and you think, I don't know what this is, but I can learn about it.
Thanks very much. Roger.
Okay, so we were asked for one word, so my one word would actually be democracy. I think, what can we do about it? Well, I'll go back to schools. I'd need to take advice from teachers who teach people before 16, but I think there's an awful lot we can do with 16 to 18-year-olds, and Brexit creates a great example, because I repeatedly hear, you know, that Brexit was a democratic majority. Well, it's very easy to talk to kids about John Stuart Mill, de Tocqueville, tyranny of the majority. A majority vote doesn't necessarily make things something democratic, and we can talk about other values in liberalism, about rational debate, honesty, and so on. So I think I would look at schools a lot. I would, you know, if I was younger and active in the Political Studies Association, I'd be very much looking at a better way to teach citizenship and being British to pre-16-year-olds. I think at present it's a checkbox. And secondly, if we look at voters, people over 18 years of age, I am a believer in radical democratic reform, including going back to some ancient Greek ideas where we have far more offices chosen by lot. That only really exists now in jury service. There's a lot of evidence, and I think it came up in some of the earlier conversation, that educated people don't necessarily make better decisions. And I think we need to look at things like Irish citizens' assemblies. There are dangers with those that the more educated tend to get in, but they are meant to be stratified. We need to make ordinary people think they have more of a say.
Thanks very much, Roger. Paul, your final thoughts.
Someone mentioned the liberal left and, you know, the buzzwords that they often employ in inclusivity and tolerance, etc. My friend Maurice Glasman often makes the point that actually, when you listen to their arguments, there's none so exclusive as those who preach inclusivity. There's none so intolerant as those who preach tolerance. And when they talk about diversity, the truth is when you look at some of these people, they mix in their own little groups that are some of the less diverse groups of people that you've ever seen. So there's an awful amount of hypocrisy there. I think in terms of where we need to go. Someone once said to me, and I think she was absolutely right, that the difference between, you know, the liberal left who are so dominant culturally and millions of working class people is can be summed up by saying that they see their country as a shop, whereas most working class people see their country as a home. So for the former group, often it's a very sort of transactional business, which is there to do business and to make a profit in the global marketplace. Whereas for ordinary working class people, they're much more rooted, and that's why they do sometimes have issues over things like open borders, because it can violate their sense of place. At the end of the day, we are social and parochial beings with an attachment to place. And if I could sum up, you know, where we've gone wrong, I think over the last couple of decades or so, we forgot the politics of belonging, and we need to find them again.
Thanks very much, Paul. Can we thank all the panel, please?